again. It is, of course, a magnificently prominent city in both the Old and New Testament. So I have had occasion, a wide variety of different books that we've taught through these recent years, had occasion to look at that city. And so a lot of times you've seen various angles and aerials and approaches to photographing this great city of Jerusalem. The photograph you see before you, of course, is at a sunset there. So you can see it's darkening and looking from the Mount of Olives across the Kidron Valley at the Temple Mount itself. I particularly like this picture because it will show you kind of the rest of Jerusalem, if you will, because beyond the Golden Dome that you have there, that hill that you see rising in the distance, is outside of the city walls of what is called the Old City, and it gives you an idea then of how very modern, you know, very tall, high-rise buildings that you have in a very much larger city today, very technologically advanced city today, than perhaps population-wise, as of course, well technologically, as it was so long ago. But it's a frustrating city from some aspects, too, because just in the New Testament, and about a month ago we were talking about Jerusalem in the Old Testament, just in the New Testament, there's 142 times that the city is actually named, that the word Jerusalem appears. Mount of Olives or Olivet is two different ways to designate the hills to the east of Jerusalem, and those terms are used 12 times in the New Testament. The word hill or Gehenna, just referring to the Valley of Hinnom, there's a number of different terms for this valley. It is found in various forms 12 times in the New Testament. Zion or Mount Zion is 7 times in the New Testament, more often in the Old. Kidron, of course, is that valley that is referenced quite a bit, though only named once. And so we have just an enormous number of geographical references that are specifically related to Jerusalem and the immediate area about it. So we're going to go through a number of slides very rapidly tonight in an overview, various aspects of which you will have seen before. But because it is so prominent, I'm confident you'll understand that rehearsing material we've already seen before is still yet a good idea. I've introduced new thoughts as we go through these various slides. But hopefully, after an overview, sort of an introduction here, we'll try to delve into quite a bit of information now tonight that will be of a nature that I've never done before. I'm hoping to kind of zoom in, if you will, on the city much more tightly than we've done in the past. So as we zoom out, you've seen several times, thanks to our technologies again, satellite photos of Israel proper. That is a great cropping that shows the fullest extent of Israel to this day. And we have, as you can see, 65 miles between the southern end of the Sea of Galilee to the northern end of the Dead Sea, but I've got equals 200 miles because the Jordan River is so convoluted that it actually, if you're in a canoe, you know, would be 200 miles to travel the straight line of 65. At its widest there, you can see it's about 50 miles from the Mediterranean Sea, due east across to, again, the northern shore of the Dead Sea. And then within the circle there, right on that line, is Jerusalem. So Jerusalem is in the more populated regions, about a third of the way up from the bottom, two-thirds of the way down, you know, from the top there, and not quite dead center, but pretty well between the Mediterranean and the Sea of Galilee or the Dead Sea. From space, once again, as you look now very directly down upon the Old City, that's what Jerusalem looks like. We're going to spend quite a bit of time now, you know, trying to identify the east and the west and the north and the south right there and to give you an overview. I know we've touched on this before, but as I say, we're kind of zooming in later. So the north, the south, the east, and the west of Jerusalem itself, that is the Old City, that is the ancient city, that is not the modern city. This is the walled city, identifiable by the walls that Herod the Great had produced some 2,000 years ago, the remnants of which exist to this very day, is right there. So we've got to turn, so usually the north is at the top, this time to the right. But as we take away two of those, just so we can see what we're doing there, this Kidron Valley that is so prominent in the life of Jesus that he's constantly crossing, and particularly in that last week, Lazarus, Mary, and Martha lived at the bottom of the screen just over the hillside from Olivet that's at the very bottom of the Mount of Olives there. You know, that red borderline is the Kidron Valley itself. You can see how very close it comes to what is the eastern wall of Jerusalem and simultaneously the eastern wall of these 36 acres that is the Temple Mount itself. So there's your Kidron Valley. Then Mount Zion now is on the southwest side of the city, though today it'll be at the top left, so a little bit odd, but within that circle is really a very small hill, this nice little conical kind of a hill that is the hill after which Jerusalem is most often named. The Temple Mount, as I mentioned a moment ago, I've now outlined right there. We know exactly where those walls are. Herod built those walls, though, in the 1500s, Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, when the Muslims were in control, had built on top of those foundations. About 36 acres right there where the Golden Dome of the Rock is now and the Temple of Old once stood. Clearing away, you know, all of that. The Valley of Gehenna in the north, it's dog-leg thing like that, so that the Valley of Gehenna, or Valley of Hinnom, starts right there where that V is, and then turns 90 degrees. So first it heads south, and then it turns east, and you can see then it connects with the Kidron. So on three sides, throughout all of antiquity, when we didn't have aircraft to take aerial photographs, we didn't have great missiles that we could launch, you know, all this time, when you had to attack a city on foot or horseback, or with siege engines, when you had to do it from the ground level, this city is enormously well protected. It's uphill on three sides. And today, these valleys have been filled in because of various conquests and just by virtue of nature itself and natural erosion. They're more gentle now, these valleys, than once they were. 1800s, as various people have either photographed or painted pictures of it, you know, much more dramatic. It's thought that the Kidron Valley today is about 60 feet higher than where the water was flowing 2,000 years ago. But it is a naturally defensible city. It has wonderful panoramic views in all directions, so it's beautiful. It just has everything to commend it. Now, there's that same photograph again. I've just shoved it over to the right there because I wanted to outline the city walls. You can see them in the shadow, you know, so inside the red area that I'm painting right there. This is the old city. When you hear that term, this is the city of Jesus' day. This is the city, for that matter, of Solomon, David's day. It's the city that would have been much smaller, going all the way back to Abraham and Melchizedek, but it sat on those hills right there. And what that represents is 0.9 miles from corner to corner this way, 0.9 miles, you can see it's not a perfect square, as opposed to, now, whoop, gotta get that to go, there you go, 0.75 miles in the other direction. So it's not big. It's not even a full mile at its longest point. And then you've got 0.6 miles directly across from side to side right here, so that typically it's referred to as a kilometer or 0.6 miles of square footage that you have all together. I circled this right here just because that's the building that I mentioned this morning. I lived in that structure for 2 weeks back in June because I just wanted to try and get a feel for this city. I wanted to live in it. I wanted to hear its sound, smell its odors. I wanted to see and experience every way that I possibly could. So I slept there 13 nights. And then roamed that city. I didn't want to go far outside its environment. I wanted to see every archaeological site that I possibly could. So I really tried in those 2 weeks to just bore into Jerusalem and hopefully be able to help you with it a little bit here tonight. All that is, brethren, is 220 acres. That is not a lot of land. And as of 4 years ago, the last time that I could find an official count, there were 44,500 people living inside walls, contained, you know, in the bucket. And that means really compact and pressed together. And of these 44,500 people, 68% of them are Muslim. 30,000 are Muslim. There's only about 7,589 at that point in time, or 17% of the city that identifies itself as Jewish. Of course, we've talked about that at great length. It's impossible to know if anybody is a Jew today. It's really kind of a silly thing from a biblical point to claim that you are. I take great delight in asking people who claim to be Jews what tribe they're of. And of course, they can't answer the question, and they know they can't. And I've seen several just be very embarrassed, you know, by that fact. As a biblical definition goes today, there's no such thing as a Jew. It's a political entity. It's been in existence, you know, since 1948 and all of that. But, you know, from a biblical standpoint, no such thing. There is, nominally, and actually in the same way as people calling themselves Jews, 5,871 who identify themselves as Christians. That's no more Christian by biblical definition than the Jews are Jews by biblical definition. They don't look like the Christians of the first century. They didn't become a part of these various churches the way the New Testament says that you should become a part of the Lord's church. But that's the way that it's designated today. So denominational people total about 13%. 68% Muslim, 17% Jewish of some stripe, 13% quasi-Christian, and that's not 100% because there are a few, you know, others that are living in the city, but it's just, it's really packed. Now, as you look north, this particular photograph, I know I've shown you before because I've hunted and hunted for hours and hours trying to find, you know, the best photograph to depict what the region looks like, and the lighting was just right, and the direction was just right, and all of that. Whoever took this photo, I didn't take this one, but here you can see the Kidron Valley running up like this all the way up right to there. That's Mount Scopus. This is all the Mount of Olives, and the Kidron Valley running just like that all the way through here. This is the intersection with the Valley of Gehenna. There's your dog leg, just like that. And so the city's walls that we just outlined a moment ago, very plainly seen right there. And this gives you a nice view, too, of how much more city there is surrounding the old, defensible city of Jesus' time. And there were people living on those hills at that time as well. Psalm 125, which we've looked at a couple of times before, begins by saying, "Those who trust in the Lord are as Mount Zion, which cannot be moved, but abides forever. As the mountains surround Jerusalem, so the Lord surrounds his people from this time forth and forever." There are just hundreds, I guess, of allusions to Jerusalem so that we can appreciate some aspect of our relationship to our God. As mountains surround Jerusalem, here you can just see them in all directions, then God surrounds his people. He uses this as a picture. We miss this picture if we don't understand the lay of the land, because it's dependent upon the lay of the land. God is on your side. God is everywhere you look. God is above you. He is caring for you and protecting you. God is your defense. Fear not, for if the Lord is with you, then what? Who can be against you? If the hills surround Jerusalem as the mountains surround this city. Now, as we start to get into the scriptures, as I said a few weeks back, we looked only at Old Testament Jerusalem. Now we'll look only at New Testament Jerusalem. The first time the city is named in the New Testament is in the Gospel of Matthew. It's the only one that tells this little story. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews?" Now, I thought these people may have come from so far away as Babylon. It's just, you know, far distant east. But they've come looking for the king of the Jews. Well, if you're looking for the king of the Jews, then where do you go? Jerusalem. You go to Jerusalem. "For," they said, "we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Now, once again, I just want us to see something of the scope. Now, in this case, here's your Valley of Gehenna, Valley of Hinnom. Here's that Kidron again, flowing along past the eastern wall and up to what would be Mount Scopus. Once again, this time, rather than looking north, we're looking more westerly, trying to give you a sense of the hills surrounding Jerusalem, of the large amount of building that's taking place outside the city at this time, but which would have been covered with little villages and houses and farming that was going on in the time of Jesus. And so this is the city of the great king that is mentioned in Matthew 5. I say to you, make no oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by the earth, for it is the footstool of his feet, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. God wanted the eyes of the world to focus on these hills for centuries throughout the Old Testament and the New. That is the city of God. That is the city of the great king. It was to represent him. It was to contain his people. It's where the temple was built, as you can see right here in that area on the 36 acres so clearly defined by the rectangular wall of Herod's day that endured 2,000 years. And in the distance now, you can see the Dead Sea. 14 miles away, the Jordan enters into the Dead Sea just about right there. 14 miles away is the Dead Sea, the lowest place on earth. All Jerusalem and Judea went out to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But initially, when all of that uproar took place, it was in the city of the great king, surrounded by these hills, known by all the world, far away is Babylon. This is where Yahweh is. This is the people and the capital city of Yahweh, that God, no other God, and a God, of course, who is the only true and living God. In Matthew chapter 20 now, verses 17 through 19, as Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 aside by themselves, and on the way he said to them, behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify, and on the third day he will be raised up. That word up appears several times there, but twice, you know, we're going up to Jerusalem. In most directions and throughout Israel, Jerusalem is uphill. It's on a ridgeline. In fact, it's on the water-dividing ridgeline. There are places where you can actually stand, and you can put 1 foot over here and 1 foot over there. And if a drop of rain falls to the right, it goes to the Mediterranean Sea. And if it falls to the left, 2 or 3 inches, then it's heading for the Dead Sea. Okay? Because Jerusalem is straddling that ridgeline that is that spine of Israel. So they're going up from virtually everywhere in Israel. You are going up to Jerusalem. Now, once again, this is one of the better photographs that I've been able to find in for the definition's sake. Though Jerusalem proper is kind of out of sight over here, you can really see all the Dead Sea along here now. And what are the hills? Of course, the wilderness of Judea where Jesus was tempted. So many things have taken place either in the city or immediately adjacent to this city that are the center of all things as God drew the attention of the world to his Son, to his Savior, to the Redeemer, to the Lord, who is our God, as well as brother, as Luke portrays, of course, Thomas saying, my Lord and my God. Jesus came here because his Father had designated this city. I'm sorry, I see that something's going a little bit wrong with the type there. I kind of missed this one. But here now, we want to descend into that city and try to really get something of the flavor of the times. In Matthew 21, verses 9 through 11, it says, the crowds were going ahead of him, and those who followed were shouting, Hosanna, to the Son of David. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest. And when he had entered Jerusalem, all the city was stirred, saying, who's this? And the crowds were saying, this is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth in Galilee. Now, in the next couple of paintings that you'll see here, both of these, this one and the next, are murals that have been painted on walls in Jerusalem itself. Painted by artists and with a view to descriptions of Jerusalem that we find not only in the New Testament and the Old, but you know, throughout history. Many travelers have gone to this place because they recognize it from the Magi and before as the city of the great king, the city of the Jews. But I want you to see this particular mural right here because they did it in a life-size manner, and it very accurately depicts, we think, what first century Jerusalem would have looked like. Today we've got, you know, ruins. I try to help you to see the scale, to appreciate the environment that Jesus and the apostles, for instance, were walking around in. But these pillars and the roof from the to protect from the weather, shade, and rain, of course, were used for the sake of providing cover for an enormous amount of commerce. It is a bustling city, it has always been. It's a city of cacophony. There's always, you know, noise and activity. It's just such a vibrant city. So you try to imagine yourself, the animals, the children, and the musicians, and everybody, you know, buying all these things. And what do you see over here? And what you got is a guy wearing, you know, an orange vest right here. But he's also got prayer beads. Apparently he's a Muslim. He was sitting here, quasi-guard duty, whatever he was doing, I never made it out, you know, but he's simultaneously, he's doing his prayers for Islam at that time, very much like the Catholic Rosary, for instance. And so, I love this picture because it helps us to see it was beautiful, it was impressive, it was very, you know, functional, well-designed, well-built, and the city just really worked. Now, on a different wall, but again in the immediate vicinity of the Temple Mount itself, these are on the Cardo, which was the main north-south city of the, or street rather, of the time. This is the wall with the painting. This is an actual pillar, the remains of a pillar that was immediately in front of it. And then, as you're standing in this area, you can't see it now, but the pillars, like this one, that were these pillars, are behind me as I take this photograph. And so you're standing down in the area that they think would have looked just like this. And we've got these pillars, these columns, that are there to show us, you know, that they were supporting a great roof structure. And then, once again, what do you see? These shops were set up so that you'd give a 10 by 10 area or whatever, you know, to each of these various vendors, and they would sell their various wares. Of course, everybody loves this one. You know, it's one of the more famous wall murals in the world. What do you notice down here? See how they painted it as first century, and then they put this little boy with a backpack, you know, interacting with the little girl of his age, you know, to show the crossover now. We're standing here now in the same place. We don't look like these people did anymore. The animals are long gone, you know. But this gives you something of the scope of the city. That would just be one little stretch of the main street in ancient Jerusalem. Today, when you go to the town, it's, you know, different. Now, this artist painted this in the 1800s. And in the 1800s, you've still got various ways of providing shade. It's a hotter, you know, kind of a city. But once again, you've got your vendors sitting around with their various products, animals running loose, people selling stuff. You know, this is commerce. But this was Jerusalem in the 1800s. And here is a typical street in the old city. Everything I've done now is alluded ourselves to the old city, the city of Herod, the city of Jesus and the apostles. This is what it looks like today. It looks a lot like what we had, you know, in the murals, doesn't it? Pretty much the same thing, as a matter of fact. And it is, you know, to our senses, just so overwhelming. It's disorienting when you go into Jerusalem. It's an assault upon the senses. It's all of these people are calling to you and trying to sell you their wares. You know, it's just a really frenetic, active kind of an environment. It is loud because, since time immemorial, brethren, they use these stones to be the streets of the city. Few of them are wide enough to get a car in, though frequently you have to get out of the way and press yourself against the wall as somebody in some tiny little thing, you know, tries to get through there. Believe it or not, they drive vehicles on these streets as well. Yeah, it's just such a typical picture of what it's like to be in Jerusalem today. Now, these streets are everywhere. Jerusalem is on a hill. It is a hill, and it's very lumpy, you know, in those 220 acres. It just seems like you can hardly ever find a place that's flat. And so, through the ages, they've also put these stones in, so that now motorcycles and bicyclists and the guy with their three-wheeled carts and all of that, who are bringing all these products in the morning, you should see how crowded it gets and busy. All the vendors come in, you know, first thing in the morning, and before the end, the customers show up, and they're just busily, you know, packing in all the products for the day. But above it is where these people live. You're always down in a chasm. You're always down in a trench. The sun will come straight down for only an hour or two, you know, in the day. And the rest of the time, it's always in shadow because it's so tall. It's 2, 3, and 4 stories above your head as you walk these streets. And every imaginable thing, and many that you've never heard of before, so you can't even imagine them, of candies and of fruits and vegetables and various kinds of breads, anything you can imagine to eat or to wear or to lie on or cover up with, you know, everything that you can imagine, you know, is on these streets. And so these are, you know, the commercial parts I'm showing you of Jerusalem. And there are several miles worth of these streets lacing all through the town. And it just drives you crazy. And marvelous, you know, numbers of things that will catch your eye that you might be interested in wanting to own, you know, to take on home with you. So Jerusalem is today, I suspect, brethren, the old city, not new city, old city, city of Jesus' day, was like that then. Wasn't built for cars then. It's not built for cars now. It's, you know, 6/10 square miles worth 220 acres of do it on foot. That's just the way it has always, always worked. It is colorful. It is aromatic. It is just constantly busy. It is an amazing and interesting town. You just don't see a whole lot like this. It is a Middle Eastern city. It is an Eastern way of doing things. It is no Safeway. It doesn't work like that. Now, this particular picture I took from the wall of Jerusalem, from what is the northern wall of Jerusalem. And I took this photograph down here because in those 2 weeks, this was a little store I shopped in a lot. I picked this as my favorite. So whatever little weet is, you can tell that's not Hebrew, that's Arabic. So I was buying, you know, mostly from Arabic shop owner there. But, you know, that's a typical moment in the Jew or mostly predominantly now Muslim life of the time. And then here are a couple of guys I really enjoyed. I was coming home one night and I'm walking through, it was getting late, I hadn't had my dinner yet, I suppose about 8 or 9 o'clock here. And there's really your typical vendor, though perhaps either one of the hungrier ones and less successful, or maybe one of the more ambitious, I'm not sure. But it just struck me as being so typical. Everywhere you look, you got a table, you got a business. Okay, you got a table, you got a store. And so I came upon these guys, and they were selling various kinds of meats right there, you know, putting them in a piece of bread. And so I bought some and spent a moment just kind of talking to these guys. And again, these are Muslim vendors on a typical city street. Again, I want you to see, this is the Via Dolorosa. And so I'm living just up around the corner now, so if you go through these arches, some of it is covered. And just see how the paving and everything works. It is a hard, hard environment. Everything is stone, so it echoes. But that is the city of Jerusalem. Now, this morning I wanted to throw this out. I showed you, you know, how everything locks up at night. When I snapped this photograph, you can see everybody went away. And all that stuff that was hanging down from all of the overhangs, you know, they need their hooks and sticks, you know, to go get it for you. What happens? It just all disappears. And bang! Everybody locks up. It's gone. Because it's a city of gates. It's a city of doors and gates. So if you come with me now, we're going to read a few verses from the class this morning. Acts chapter 12, verses 6 through 18, we considered this morning. In Acts 12 and verse 6, it says, on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers. So we've gotten deep into the night. Peter's arrested. He's already gone to sleep, though, and Herod's contemplating killing him, as he had in verse 2, James, the brother of John. 44 A.D., when Herod was about to bring him out, Peter's sleeping, he's bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. Behold, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter's side and roused him, saying, get up quickly, and his chains fell off his hands, and the angel said to him, gird yourself, put on your sandals, and he did so. And he said to him, wrap your cloak around you, and follow me. And he went out, and continued to follow, and he did not know that what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. And when Peter came to himself, he said, now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting. This is Herod Agrippa the First. It is a son of Herod and a brother to Herodias. Now, when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, Peter did, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. And when he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter was standing in front of the gate. They said to her, you're out of your mind. But she kept insisting it was so, and they kept saying, it is his angel. But Peter continued knocking, and when they'd opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. Motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of the prison, and he said, report these things to James and the brethren. And he departed and went to another place. Now, when day came, there was no small disturbance. So what I thought I'd do here is try to help us understand these gates. And oh, just a few more pictures here. I'll be done for the evening. But this is the Damascus Gate. There are two exceptionally busy gates in the city. This one's in the north wall. It is, you know, the tourist trap and all the rest of that, because it has this wonderful plaza with all these steps that you can sit upon, and people will set up their little table, you know, and start selling their wares. And then, right here in the circle, I just want you to notice this guy with the shades, though. This is one of those very busy gates. They are designed so that as you approach the wall of Jerusalem, which we just read Peter's done, you go through this gate, see how big it is, but doors can be locked, so you cannot enter. And when you go inside, you're inside a big block structure here where you're forced to turn left and then right again to get out of the box. So it's designed for defense. Even if somebody could batter down the door, they'd still be caught in a trap where the soldiers, you know, and defenders would be just massacring them with their arrows and spears and whatnot in hand-to-hand combat. So this is just, you know, kind of a typical entrance, you know, to the gate right there. Now, as we zoom in, though, on that guy I was just talking about, he's over here. What do you notice there about him? As we zoom in again, what he and a couple of his buddies were doing was they had these four giant snakes draped around their shoulders, and they were selling photograph opportunities, is what it was. So the longest time I just sat there at that plaza and I was watching those guys, you know, thinking, You spend most of your time in Jerusalem, brethren, much like this, by which I mean everybody's touching you. You're walking around, just working your way through a crowd. These people, by the hundreds, are working their way, and then went, huh? What are they find? These big snakes draped around these guys who are just simply trying to sell photographs. And I also like this shot. I was proud of this one again, you know, because I caught this Arab guy over here with his cell phone taking pictures, you know, and then the typical bag that the Arabs are always using, and the men and the women both, you know, use more like a purse as we do. And so, you know, I don't know what they were doing in the first century as far as, you know, the garb goes, but I think, again, that this sort of a headdress, because of the heat and all, you know, would be more the traditional kind of a thing you might have expected, you know, a togo-like kind of a thing, you know, there in the first century. So this typical crowding, and you're just selling anything that you can. You never know, you know, what you're going to bump into, who you're going to see or have an opportunity to converse with. Now, one thing I want you to get about this, though, is if an event takes place in the city, even if it's 9/10 of a mile farthest end of the city, how long would it take for the news to travel through that town? It would just take moments. Because if there's an uproar, everybody knows it. Everything is stone on all sides, and so it just echoes and reverberates. If something gets loud, you know, everybody's just having it amplified. It's all reflecting back on you. And if you want to shout down the street then to somebody, hey, get the police, then off they go. And you can just illuminate, you know, inform the whole city in just moments. You can get, you know, activity taking place. And so, as we start to bring this to a close now, though, in Acts chapter 12, it was after dark. Now, I haven't been able to find very many photographs after dark, so these I took myself. It was about 11:15, 11:30, you know, one night I was coming back, you know, to that location I was telling you about. And I just thought these pictures, though, are helpful because, once again, you can see how you have iron gates, you have various barricades, can immediately be put in place. This is still the city of 2,000 years ago. Also, a city that is just swimming in cash. There are everywhere you look. But as I was coming home that day, you know, it's still very well lit. I could walk for 10 and 15 minutes at a time in 220 acres and never come across another soul there 11:15 at night. But I just felt, you know, so like, you know, a rabbit, you know, in a warren, I guess, you know. But it's just such a labyrinth. It's such a maze. Brethren, I believe that it always has been the descriptions of Josephus from the first century and so many other travelers. Always, you know, it seems like on an angle, doing stairs or doing slopes, but in a very tightly enclosed area with people by this time of night fast asleep above my head in apartments that are 2 and 3 stories high. There's no room, you know, for an automobile. It feels very claustrophobic. It feels very, you know, tight and constrained and kind of makes us a little bit nervous, you know, and all of that from the way that we live. But this is the city, brethren, still of Jesus' day. It was a city where people were together. It is a city where news traveled fast. It is a city where you were forced to be in physical contact with people if you just wanted to get down to buy a loaf of bread or, you know, a good chicken sandwich. It was a city, brethren, that was the city of the great king. It is the city that God chose as the center of the world for his temple, for his name, for his law, and for his people, as we read of those things in so many different passages of Scripture. It is from that city from whence the gospel went to all the world, and did so in an extremely short time, with people who are no smarter than you are, with people who are no more devoted than you are, with people who are no more wealthy than you are, with people that are no more talented than you are, with just people, fishermen to begin with, and all the various denizens of Jerusalem. The law was prophesied to come forth from this city in Isaiah chapter 2. went out into all the world from that town. Now, brethren, we have enormous advantages over what they have. We've got the internet, we've got telephones, we've got automobiles, you know, we've got all these great and wonderful comforts. What maybe we lack is the people of earth today. I don't mean us, you know, personally, but what maybe we lack is just that same sense of being the chosen people of God that first the Jews of old and then the Christians of the New Testament time felt as they dwelt in the great city of the King. And then were driven from it, gave up everything they owned to proclaim that gospel to the world. Driven out by persecution in the first verses of chapter 8 by a persecutor who himself would come to the knowledge of the truth. I just hope that we will learn the lessons that no matter where you live, no matter what the circumstances, you too can let your light shine, can be a great light to the world. You too, in your time and your place, can have enormous influence over the people with whom you come into contact, a much wider number thanks to Facebook and those kinds of things, you know, than they had access to in that day. And so Zion is still calling, brethren, that mountain of old. If you'll be ready now, we'll be singing in just a moment, number 285. Zion's call, you know, sweetly rings over land and sea, bidding us look to realms above. May it be so. May we take our advantages and in our times be of service to our King. If we can help you in that regard, do you have an interest in a particular Bible topic for study or maybe some personal issues going on and looking for some insight or perhaps some help in prayer or even ready to become a Christian here this very night, let it be known. Come speak with me, please.